Welcome to a new edition of the Famous Interviews with Joe Dimino. On this episode, we talk with former Major League Baseball pitcher, author, and speaker Brandon Puffer. After a 15-year Major League Baseball career, he has fallen to great depths and came out on the other side with important lessons that he wants to share with those who might find themselves facing tough obstacles or setbacks in their own lives. One of his proudest roles in his life today is being the coach for a nonprofit baseball organization that helps young people develop their baseball talent. In the end, his faith has guided him through dark times with grace, courage, and the utmost determination. His story is a must hear. Enjoy this interview.
Hey, Brandon, what's up, man?
Oh, man, living the dream. How are you, brother?
I love it. Everything's good, man. Thanks for taking some time out.
Absolutely. Not a problem. I look forward to it.
You got a great story, man. I'm looking forward to getting into it. And before we get to your story, I want to know, the time that we spent on Earth with COVID the last couple of years has been quite tumultuous. You seem like a very personable, community-driven person. How did you survive that time period? How did that change the way that not only you live your life as a person, but as a professional?
The time during the quarantine, well, like everything else, Joe, I think, as you know, when you're grateful and you're optimistic and you try to live a positive lifestyle, you just got to make the most of it, regardless of what it is. And so, yeah, in terms of personally, we have a baseball facility here in Austin, Texas. I made a gym out of it. Physical fitness is a big part of my mental health, and I think a lot of other folks. And so turned that place into half of it into a gym and worked out daily. And then just listened to podcasts and read a lot. And privately, I own a nonprofit select baseball program, and so we weren't able to do much. So we got partnered with some folks that did some workouts online and just kept our athletes going and provided things for them during that time. Like everybody else, just kind of adjusted and adapted and did a lot of Zoom and things off that app.
So let me ask you this. If you were in front of a bunch of third graders right now at a career day, and one of the kids looked up at you, and they want to have an accurate picture of what you do for a living, what would you say to them? How would you explain it?
I would say, honestly, quite simply, I'm a coach and a motivational speaker. I think that's the terms I would use for them to understand at the third grade level. And overall, through the coaching and the speaking and sharing my story, that I'm just someone who tries to encourage others. And maybe it's from something I've accomplished, or maybe it's from something I've done that was a big mistake that helps other people learn from it. But ultimately, I just see myself as a coach and a motivator. And that's about the gist of what I do. And I try to implement those two things in everything I do.
Let's make you a third grader. And I want to know, what were you dreaming of? Was it Major League Baseball when you were a child? What did you want to do with your life?
Joe, it was 100% Major League Baseball. And I would sit in class and work on signatures, and I wrote a little letter to my parents that, hey, this is going to happen. I will be a Major League Baseball player. And so I kind of was a hyper-focused, individual on that. And that was a dream I always wanted to come see, to fruition. And fortunately for me, just kind of having some ability as I grew up, I mean, when you're third grade, you love the sport, but you don't know if physically you're going to be, able to pursue that or, what's going to happen. But yeah, I would say as early as third grade, for sure, that was my dream and my goal.
I remember one time when I was in junior high, there was a guy that came into our class, and I think he was a scout, and he grabbed a pen, didn't say anything, walked in, and he put a .0000734, and he turned around, he looked at us, and he said, "What does that number mean to you guys?" We're all just junior high kids. We have no idea what he's going after, and he's like, "That's the chance that you'll have of becoming a professional athlete." And we just was like, wow.
So wow.
It was wild, man. But his point was, you change all these careers in your life. But when I think about guys like you that get to live that takes so much sacrifice to get to that point.
Yeah, it does. And I think there's a lot of value in what that scout did. Because again, I mean, realistically, there is a small percentage. And not to crush dreams or have anybody be upset or not continue to pursue that dream. But I think what the point they're trying to make is have backup plans, have other interests, have, things that, I've been so fortunate and blessed that to this day I coach and I'm involved in the game, and maybe it is because it's all I can do. But at the end of the day, I do encourage our guys, like, hey, those rosters are going to be full every year, so why not you? Absolutely. I mean, without a doubt. But, you know, yes, it is a very small percentage, and you need to have other things that you're looking towards doing, because even if you do get to play 10 or 15 years, I played 15, it's going to come to an end, and then who are you outside of baseball? You know what I mean?
Tell me where you were at when you finally got that very first phone call to the majors, and what did you do after you got that call?
Yeah, I was in New Orleans, Louisiana, in AAA for the Astros, the New Orleans Zephyrs. Came in after the game. The manager said, hey, you need to see you in my office. And I want to say it was April 16th. Went in, he gave me the speech. Hey, the big club needs you tomorrow. You're going to meet the team in Cincinnati. I pretty much just checked out from that point on. I was floating around. I had a flight in the morning, so I got all my stuff packed up. And then I made a call to my wife at the time and all my family and went down the line in the parking lot there of, you know, in tears and you know, tears of joy of just sharing that with everybody that I'm going to get my opportunity and that dream that we've all had. And it takes a lot of support from your loved ones and everyone else that it's coming to fruition. You know, tomorrow I was going to take a flight off to Cincinnati the next day and join the Astros.
In all of that time that you're looking at this dream that you want to go after, you know, sometimes we're only as good as the shoulders we stand on. Who was that hero for you? Who was that consistent cheerleader that you looked up to that made you really want to go to where you wanted to go?
That's a good one. You know, really for me, it's my parents. It really is. I'm just real fortunate. I kind of won the parent lottery in that. My mom is just super encouraging. She was an athlete. She was a triathlete. And so I watched her, to your point, sacrifice and get up early before work to swim or bike or run. And she does to this day. And so it was just always more walked out than spoken of, hey, if this is something you want to do, then you find a way to do it and you put the work in consistently every single day. And my dad as well, he actually fought some demons, you know, in his personal life, you know, maintained sobriety or came to a point of sobriety, and watching him kind of turn his life around and just kind of two different pictures of what it looks like to kind of take something head on, one being, you know, an addiction and one being a athlete who wanted to continue to excel and push herself and do those things. So taking both those things together, I think, you know, really made me the type of person I am and being like, hey, you know, why not me? Or I'm going to continue to work as hard as I can until absolutely the wheels fall off. And then I can know at the end of the day, I've done everything I can do. And I think it took a lot of persistence. I didn't make the big leagues until about my seventh year in on the minor leagues. I'd already been released by two or three teams. I went to an independent league, became the first guy out of that league to sign with a major league team. So there was certainly some times where it would have been easy to quit had you not had the home front saying, hey, you know, this, you said you're going to do this. You know, there's going to be ups and downs and adversity, and let's see what you're made of now, and just continue to take that mindset with the support of my parents and my brother.
You know, the one thing about retired professional athletes is the public has this perception. I know, you know, for instance, on a higher end, like Shaquille O'Neal is involved with all these other things. And, you know, even here in Kansas City, when Marcus Allen retired, he opened up car dealerships. And you always see kind of these things that happen, but from your perspective, what's a common misperception the public has about athletes after they retire and what they want to do with their lives from there on out?
That's a great question. I wish I had Shaq or Marcus Allen money, so I couldn't sit around for very long.
Right.
But you know, no matter who it is, you know what I mean? And maybe it's why someone like Tom Brady or Verlander in baseball play so long, because they wonder, how am I going to get what this gives me in terms of the adrenaline, the juices, the drive to every day get up and go through that routine? Because, I mean, there's really no off season. I mean, your routine is from the time you wake up to the time you go to sleep is all based on your performance and you know, those types of things. So I think it's that guys will just kind of retire off in the sunshine, and guys that you mentioned, they've got plenty of money. They're just going to enjoy the rest of their lives. Well, they've been kind of it's been ingrained in them for so long, routine and purpose and being judged on your performance, that that's just not possible for most. I mean, maybe some can do it. They can ride in the sunshine and go to the beach and be good. But most of these guys are competitors to no end. And they just, they want to continue to not only compete and to get that thing that makes their juices flow, but also to be productive, you know, to be somebody who I know for me personally, it's okay. I want to do something that's going to help others and pass this on. And that's where kind of our youth and high school program came about. And, you know, different little ventures I get into is just, it's just that it's like, you want to continue to push yourself and become a better version of you. So, okay, what do I have with life after baseball, in my case, baseball or whatever sport it is, you know, how can I use what I did and how fortunate I was to do that to kind of make the world a better place daily is I think how most people view it. I think everyone's different, but I'm just speaking kind of for myself. And I know there's a lot of athletes that are buddies of mine that see it the same way. It's like, well, why do you still do and push and drive? And you made plenty of money, and that, not speaking to me, but other guys, and they're like, well, that's not purpose. You know, what is my purpose every day? Why am I here? If God wakes me up and gives me breath in my lungs, then there's a purpose for me, and it's probably not to sit and kind of rest on my laurels that I had a good career and now I have plenty of money.
For sure. You know, when I think about that, maybe it's my journalistic brain that kicks in whenever I hear people say, how could Tom Brady do this? What I keep thinking is, you know, the guy wants to go out on top. That's what I'm thinking from a human perspective. One of the reasons why I would think he would come back was that I don't think he just wants to lose a playoff game. I think he wants to go out on top. But it's that whole mentality that civilians don't understand. And I've felt like that being in Kansas City, where I've seen so many teams before the Chiefs or even the Royals that were losers year after year after year. But I always go back to that thing where it's like, it's really about you guys are out there doing this. And we as civilians can't understand that. And you guys get pelted all the time. It's part of the price you pay to be in front of the public eye and to get crucified in that way, you know?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think everybody individually has to come to the point where they're okay with laying the sport down. I mean, you know, whether that's in high school or not, I get to mentor a lot of high school kids. And let's just say they're a really good baseball player and they're getting pressure to stop their second sport, be it basketball or football or whatever it is. And my question is always, you know, they'll say, coach, you know, I'm being told this because I can focus more on, you know, what I'm going to do in college. That's going to be baseball. And I said, okay, you know, yes, that's a good option and a good reason to potentially free up some time to focus on that. It's if you love this sport, be your second sport. And an example for me was I played basketball in high school and I really liked it. And I did have to stop for a couple years. Didn't have to. I chose to stop to focus on baseball. And then my senior year came around and I thought, I'm really going to regret if I don't have that high school basketball experience that I, you know, looked forward to. And so I got back involved and did it. And so each individual's got to really look at that and go, hey, you know, can I live with and be okay with and have peace with laying the sport down? Or, you know, in the case of some of the guys we talked about, I don't know, to your point about Brady, no matter when he stops, he's on top. So I don't know what drives him, and I never can choose, you know, that's his journey, not mine. But at the end of the day, I think it's got to come down to, if you still have the opportunity to play and you still have an option, at what point is it a little too much, the daily grind of just preparing yourself? Because that's the biggest part. The game itself, not to say it's easy, but it's fun. It's easy. All the work leading up to that is, I think, what causes guys to look and go, can I continue to do this? You know what I mean? Can I continue the daily grind of that? So,
you know, in your career as a baseball player, what player was out on the field that you would see that you were just like, wow, you just couldn't believe how good they were, how much fun, as much as you had to be a professional for your team and for what you were doing, what was a player that you were around where it was almost like you're in that fan mode where you're like, wow, that's just, it's amazing to watch?
Oh, wow. Yeah, there are several. I was fortunate to, you know, play with quite a few guys that, you know, will be in the Hall of Fame or are in the Hall of Fame. And you always kind of knew that. You'd look at those guys and go, what makes them different, right? I would say one of them for me was, and I think it was because he was towards the end of his career, but from what I understand, he was this way always, is Trevor Hoffman in San Diego. I'm a bullpen guy, reliever, so you spend a lot of your time with the bullpen. And he was the closer and just leader by nature, you know, just because he was A, our closer, B, he is a veteran. He was just a great guy. And he just his preparation, but he made it fun. He included everybody. I played with Barry Bonds for a short time, and nothing against Barry Bonds. Unbelievable to watch him. He'd be another one where I'd say, oh, my gosh. I mean, just as a fan, but in the short time I was with him, it was just unbelievable to watch. But he was in his own world. I mean, he didn't really care to, you know, include everyone. Hoffman was, like, such a real person, and 90% of the guys are, but Hoffman was just so real and would ask you about your family, and it didn't matter if you were Brandon Puffer, the middle reliever who has a little bit of big league time, or the veteran on the team like him. He was just so good to everybody. I always kind of wondered, like, man, what's it like to be a big star like him? They play his song and 60,000 people go crazy when he comes out. And he's just a normal dude the rest of the day. And that was very impressive to me. And there's several guys like that. Lance Berkman's another one that stood out, where it just never looked like he felt the pressure. He just had fun and was able to kind of play the game he'd always loved. And I always admired that about those guys.
You know, and I think about that as a fan when I look out and I see those cats that are really cool like that. Like, I remember the 15 Royals, you know, we went crazy, and I actually got to celebrate that with my son, who was young at the time. And I think about how cool, like, Hosmer was. Like, he just always, like, it always seemed like when the lights got really bright, he was that guy. And I remember even in Houston, when we could have lost it and not gone any further, it was like, I think it was either Hosmer or Moustakas that basically told the dugout, we're going to win this game. And it's like everybody plays their role. You got the cool guy, then you got the guy that's loud. It's like it seems like everybody fits their role, and it has to come in to sync for things to work.
You're so right. Yeah, you're so right, Joe. I think it was in 11 or 12 organizations, and then, you know, within that, you move up and down the system. And so tons of teams, man, just tons of teams. And I've always told people exactly what you just said. I go, guys, it's the same cast of characters, just a different uniform. You're going to have, as soon as you walk in, you know who's who. It's like, okay, there's the intense guy. There's the cut-up guy. There's the, you know what I mean? It's like, it's every team, to your point, has that. That's what makes it great. You know, you kind of got those different personalities and roles that make it fun. I mean, because when you're together that often and traveling and winning and losing and, you know, just kind of going through all the different ebbs and flows, peaks and valleys of a season, it takes that, you know. If everyone's that intense all the time, knuckle down guy, it's like, ugh, that's a little much, you know. Great to have them, but then you got to have the guys who keep it loose and the guys, everything in between. So you're definitely right. Every team I've ever been on, has kind of the same cast of characters, different name, different uniform. It doesn't take long to figure out who's who.
Yeah, my son actually, he's on the autism spectrum. He's 17, and he's been a sports fan his whole life. So I'll sometimes explain this principle to him, where it's like, this team on paper is really good, but I don't think the chemistry is going to work out. And, you know, we were really watching the World Series this year, and I just kept saying, you know, the Phillies remind me of the 15 Royals. There's a grit. There's something that's different about them. But the Astros, they were a machine. They were an absolute 100% machine, man. You couldn't get around them. So I always find it interesting when you really, like, break it down. There's just a reality to some teams that are just inevitable, and it's going to happen.
No, you're absolutely right. And I think what was so impressive with that is you take out a big centerpiece, right, in their shortstop, Correa, and then it's like, oh, we'll just throw this rookie Pena in. And obviously he stepped up and he had big shoes to fill, but he did his job. But it's like, you with teams like that, you know that they're clicking and they have that camaraderie when you can literally pull what seemed to be a huge piece out, put another one in, don't skip a beat. It's like, wow, that's amazing. And I, as we talk about it, I don't know exactly what they have that makes them that way, but it's obviously, you know, leadership and camaraderie and clubhouse leadership, all those things that have to be in place, because when you make a big move like that and don't skip a beat or maybe improve, that's super impressive.
So you do actually have a ring from the Red Sox, correct?
I received a World Series ring from the Red Sox. I do not have it on my person anymore, and that's part of my story.
So what happened? Why is it not on your person?
Yeah. No, great question. So, you know, obviously a big part of my story is, you know, playing baseball, making the big leagues. You know, 2004, I got called up for a very brief time with the Red Sox when they won their first World Series, and they were – so excited to have won it. I think they gave everybody, including like the peanut concession guy, a World Series ring, because I didn't contribute much at all. But I did get a ring, and it was cool. And I always joke with people, I was actually traded mid-season to the Red Sox from the Padres. And so in the beginning of the year, we played in Fenway in an interleague series, San Diego versus Red Sox. I pitched, I came out of the bullpen in a game that we lost, gave up a couple runs, Nomar hit a ball off the Green Monster off me. So every time I tell the story, I joke, I'm like, well, in a small way, I contributed, because, you know, I did pitch against them and they beat up on us. So that was helpful. But I really didn't contribute with the Red Sox at all. And they gave me a ring. And then fast forward to when my life kind of hit a dark spot and I hit a rock bottom. I was that athlete that sold my world championship ring. And that's a super embarrassing thing to share, but it's definitely a part of my story. And I ended up selling it. I was in a hard time and I had some legal fees I had to take care of. And obviously not proud to say that, but again, part of my story is that. And so then what's ironic about it was one of these things I really wanted to keep quiet. And I really just wanted to, so embarrassing. And I'm a baseball fan at heart and a purist. I'm like, man, I used to just judge and couldn't stand when people would do this. Like, how am I this guy? But you know, it sold to a private guy. You know, we kept it real private. Well, out of nowhere, about a year later, it ended up on Pawn Stars, the show. And now I'm like, you know, what was a secret is now out there, you know, in full public. People are texting me left and right, just going, hey, are you watching Pawn Stars? Hey, what's going on here? And it was the guy who had bought it was trying to sell it to the Pawn Stars. It was part of their episode. And so this is another one of those quirky little stories in my life of like, wow, well, you thought you were going to keep that one under wraps, and that went pretty public. But, you know, that's again, I know I've said it multiple times. It's just kind of a part of my story to go, look, if you think a World Series ring is going to bring you peace and joy, and you think and all these accomplishments are going to do it, I mean, look what happened to mine. I think we've all waited for since we were young, and I don't even have it anymore.
Yeah, you know, and that leads my next question here. I'm curious now that you look back on your life as a very wise, well-traveled man. You know, if you have a dream tonight and you run into, like, your 20-year-old version of yourself, and you could give that version of a piece of advice based on what you've learned in your life, what would you tell your younger version?
Yeah, a couple things. I mean, one definitely would be to learn from other people's mistakes. You don't have to go through that experience all the time yourself to learn. And I say that because I already mentioned that my dad, you know, had trouble with addiction and became sober when I was in high school. And so I had right in my house an example of kind of what it looks like in a family when it's tumultuous and there's drinking and anger and drugs and those type of things. And then what it looks like when that person changes their ways and how a family can be redeemed. And he would tell me, I mean, my dad would literally tell me, like, hey, man, this doesn't end any other way besides, you know, like death or prison or, you know, whatever the case may be. And I would say things to him like, a 20-year-old Brandon would say, well, you got sober in your mid-30s. Just look at all the fun you got to have, you know. So I could have easily just kind of took advice or wisdom from my dad and many others who had talked to us or in spring training, they'd come in to, you know, share a story, somebody would come in and share a story or, you know, kind of warn us of the perils of being a professional athlete and people are going to be tugging at you and it's a hard lifestyle. And instead of really taking that to heart and kind of working on myself at that time, I just said, oh, I'm young, you know, I'm invincible. It's not going to happen to me type mentality. And I would have paid attention much earlier when people were trying to get my attention. And in my opinion, you know, God was kind of knocking on my heart going, hey, you don't really want to go down this path. There's another way for you, but it's going to take some work. And I just kind of succumbed to a lot of those demons I fought, the addiction stuff. And that's what led to ultimately, like I said, me hitting a rock bottom. I served time in prison and, you know, at that point had to surrender my life and figure out what I wanted to do from there. But it didn't really have to come to that. It could have happened much sooner. So that's one thing I would say. And then the second thing I would say to, you know, kids that age is it's not about you. Like, it's really not about you. It's about, you know, every decision and choice you make, your family's affected. Now, granted, you have to walk out your own journey, but your family's affected, the people around you, people that care about you. So to take into consideration, you know, other people's feelings when it comes to how you're acting or how a certain action of yours could affect everybody besides just yourself. I think at that point I was just super selfish, self-absorbed, all about my career and doing what made me happy rather than really looking at the big picture of, you know, caring for the ones that love me and realizing that, hey, there are some people that look up to you, have a calling on your life, and it's not really it is your choice if you want to just kind of throw it all away and behave this way, but there's really another way you can go to kind of pay more attention to that, I would say.
So, you know, when you wake up every day, you have kind of a set agenda of what you're going to do and how you're going to do it. What do you look forward to the most? What's really driving you these days?
Yeah, I mean, I do. I'm a very routine-oriented guy. And you know, from the time I wake up, I get into a quiet time and I try to, you know, write down things I'm grateful for. And so I look forward to opportunity, to a routine. And then within that routine, I really look forward to divine appointments. Like, it just never fails. If you're looking for it, if you're personable, if you're smiling at people, you'll end up meeting folks. You'll end up having, like what I like to call divine appointments that are like, that will, you know, they may benefit you in a business world, but it may just be meeting more friends and be able to encourage more people. I really do look forward to that aspect of things now. And again, you know, prior to the way I live my life now, it was, okay, from the time I wake up, what I need to eat, what I need to work out, what I need to read, you know, it was just kind of boom, boom, boom. And I never really took time to look without and try to see, how can I encourage someone else? Like, I'm here for more than just me. And so that's what I look forward to now. Like, who am I going to be able to encourage today? And I don't, all my days aren't great. I mean, you know that, nobody's are. But even when I'm having a rough day, and you know, when I'm maybe battling with some anxiety or some depression or whatever the case may be, it never fails that I feel so much better when I try to serve somebody else. I just try to, and it could just, again, be a smile, positive word, encouraging word. I go to the gym every morning, you know, maybe encourage somebody there, whatever the case may be. Just always seems to make, you know, even selfishly, I guess, make me feel better when I'm serving and being an encouragement to other people.
So everyone out there has a perception of you, your family, your friends, all of your fans, but ultimately you're the one that's lived your life. What's your perception of you? Who do you think you are?
You know, I think honestly that I am just a man who's got self-esteem issues like everybody else, has the imposter syndrome of, why me? Why did I have this calling in my life? Why was I able to, you know, go to the big leagues? Yeah, it was hard work and had, you know, was blessed with physical talent, but why do people want to hear my story? Why am I on here today? You know, just a guy that daily kind of, and I think it's good, you know, at this point, because it keeps humility in the picture, and it keeps, you know, hey, you're not that big of a deal, but if you're willing to be used, your story can encourage people. So I would say that A, I am a guy, you can't see me, we're doing audio, but I'm a big guy, I'm 6'3", 270, but ultimately inside, I feel like I'm just a soft, insecure, don't deserve any of this type of guy. But also, I think, especially the ones close to me, I know you asked me, I guess it's hard to talk about yourself, that's why I'm deflecting it, but at the end of the day, I really am a guy that has a good heart and does care about, you know, not only his family, but others around him, and wants to, when it's all said and done, be someone that can say, hey, look, he made mistakes. You know, he wasn't perfect by any means, but at the end of the day, people liked being around him. He was encouraging. He made people feel good about themselves. And that's ultimately what I want to be. And I hope that's what people see.
So Brandon, if anybody wants to get your book, learn more about your nonprofit, anything related to you and your world these days, where's the best place for them to go?
Yeah, so it's brandonpuffer.com, and everything's on there. The book should be launching pretty soon, and so all the kind of updates and stuff like that are on brandonpuffer.com.
Cool, man. Hey, Brandon, this has been wonderful, man. Thank you for opening up. Thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
Absolutely, Joe. Have a great day, man. It was a pleasure.
Thanks for tuning in to another Famous Interview with Joe Domino, where we cover the world of art, sports, literature, and music around the globe. If you want to hear more interviews, visit the Famous Interviews with Joe Domino channel on YouTube. Thanks again for listening. And until next time.